Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the Partly Political Broadcast, the podcast that tries to find the funny side of politics, but has very much realised that it's the bit that's face down in the dirt dead. This is episode 135, I'm Tiernan Duyeb, and this week the world has reeled in shock at New Zealand, where the government have responded to a vicious and upsetting terrorist attack by showing compassion, empathy for the victims, and talk of gun reform laws. What? What on earth are they doing? Haven't they heard of thoughts and prayers? How on earth will they make a profit from decisions like that? Where's all the victim blaming? So weird. It's like they've taken absolutely no lessons from any other world leaderships. Ugh. In a horrific attack on two mosques, 50 people were killed by a white supremacist, who many commentators struggled to call a terrorist, possibly because due to the colour of the gunman's skin, they were surprised that he hadn't chosen to ruin the lives of minorities by using his privilege to get elected to a position of power and then inflict a series of damaging policies and cuts instead. It was a very upsetting incident, and the response to the disturbing massacre has mostly been an outpouring of love for the families and friends of those who died and were injured, and a call for unity overall. But it has also raised awareness of the rise of the far right in those who already knew the far right was rising but had chosen to leave it in the oven for a bit longer to see if they could just get a scent around the house so it'd make people more interested in whatever self-serving ideology they were peddling. No, it's not an attack on freedom of speech if you don't let a fascist speak on your national TV show, in the same way that refusing to smear bin juice around your face isn't detrimental to harmful bacteria. Leave it be, and eventually it'll die off or get eaten by rats before affecting anyone. It baffles me how many outlets are questioning where this violent hatred of Muslims has come from, as though they've been completely unaware of their own output for years. If your newspaper or news programme has spent the last 18 years calling Muslims terrorists or other hateful terms, or your governments have found unsubstantiated excuses to bomb Middle Eastern countries, or your nation has been allowed to vote on devastating decisions that empower the views of people terrified by anyone who isn't translucent white, and you're going, "But how has this happened?" then I'm not sure you should be allowed to do basic things like drive, as you'll probably fall asleep at the wheel and then wake up wrapped around a lamppost in Birmingham and start questioning how you got there. Thoughts and much love to all those in Christchurch that were affected, or not affected, just everyone there. What a horrible event. Right, now let's get the UK's bullshit out the way. Brexit, where there are never any steps forward, just constant steps back, as we fall over our shoelaces that the government have insisted we tie together to give us the upper hand in negotiations, assured that we can shout demands as we flail around on the floor like a pissed beetle. Last Tuesday saw Prime Minister and love child of the Pixar lamp and nurse Ratched, Theresa May, have her deal rejected again, because it turns out politicians still don't like the changes she hasn't made. After it was promised to the Commons that May had an improved deal, the big question on the table that's now covered in various Brexit options and oversized questions and when oh when will someone just clear that table and serve dessert, the big question was, what was actually improved. It looked very much the same, it smelled very much the same, and it sounded pretty much entirely the same. Was the change of May's deal within? Had May given it a different backstory? Had it Stanislavski an objective change, but we, as viewers, would only know by the finale? Who knows? But Attorney General and rejected Toby Jug, Geoffrey Cox, said the legal risk of being tied to the EU after Brexit remained unchanged, meaning that most of the extreme Brexiteers were still opposed to it, as being tied to anything gives them weird public school flashbacks. Ireland said May's deal is just the UK talking to itself, which I guess we are prone to do rather than learn enough language to converse with anyone else. Former Foreign Secretary and eyeholes poked into a raw chicken, Boris Johnson, said that the deal had reached the end of the road, as though quoting from his R&B group Boys to Man Babies. 149 votes was what May's deal was lost by, and with it, her voice, both politically and literally, as she once again croaked out that she was disappointed in the House's decision in a very much, it's not me, it's you kind of way. Why should I change my inadequate deal when it's you and your insistence on not just giving in that needs to change? Health Secretary and life vessel for teeth, Matt Hancock, tweeted that there was a strong cabinet backing for the deal, which I guess there was, but unless they're secretly Spartans, it's like applauding the strength of a knackered mountain goat that's been swept away by an avalanche. The next day was Chancellor and what if we built a man entirely out of corrugated cardboard, Philip Hammond, announcing his spring statement, where he warned that the rejection of May's deal leaves a cloud of uncertainty over the economy. Except it's not a cloud of uncertainty, is it, Phil? It's steam emanating from the pissing that the Brexit mayhem is doing all over it. Hammond's statement was largely lacking in anything useful, but he announced provisions of £100 million for police forces in England to pay for overtime to tackle knife crime, which, considering the cuts that have been made to the police force, that means they'll now only be losing £600 million by 2020, and those who don't lose their jobs are going to have to work extra hours to make up for the government not wanting to actually deal with knife crime. Still, Hammond did also announce free sanitary products in schools, so if that includes sanitary towels, teenagers can take extra to double up as dressing for stab wounds. Phil called for MPs to put their differences aside and compromise over Brexit, which is an odd thing to ask for when your leader's biggest example of compromise is occasionally forcing herself to smile as she presents the same deal again and again. Then came the vote on whether the UK should leave without a deal. Environment Secretary and puppet they take to school to warn kids about not speaking to strangers, Michael Gove, spoke passionately about the dangers of a no deal, as did several other Conservatives, who then all voted against avoiding it. How are you meant to solve divisions in a party when most of the party ministers seem to be warring with the voices in their own heads? Ministers overwhelmingly voted to reject a no deal under any circumstances, but it wasn't a legally binding vote, so as was to be expected, it's mainly led to May telling everyone that actually the only way to avoid a no deal is by her deal that also no one wants. Then the next night, MPs voted against Labour MP and proof that it's impossible to wear round glasses without looking like a comical sidekick to Sherlock Holmes, Hillary Benn, his amendment to take control of Brexit from May if she couldn't find a way forward. It lost by 2 votes. So, MPs basically said they don't want May's deal, they don't want no deal, they also don't want to be in control of it themselves, but they don't want May in control of it as she obviously isn't. It really feels like there needs to be some sort of special button that can be pressed in these kinds of situations so that Parliament just collapses to the size of a marble and someone the entire country actually trusts, like, I don't know, David Attenborough, one of the BBC Breakfast presenters, can then just pop it in their pocket and sort everything out, or maybe just roll it into an open drain. An amendment on having a second referendum was also rejected, as was Labour's amendment basically asking if they can have a go, and after a string of surprising victories, the government also won on MPs voting to have an extension to Article 50, pushing the Brexit date past March the 29th, except it isn't a win because it's also not legally binding. The EU have to agree at first, and they're only going to do that if they're given a good enough reason, to which isn't going to be just that May has slightly changed the paragraph spacing or finally put it all in a nice binder. So what now? Well, May was planning to bring back her vote yet again in the hope they'd just keep wearing everyone down until they gave in and voted for it, just so they didn't have to hear her talk again. But firstly, the DUP were not on side as there was no money involved, and then 40 Tory rebels told her they'd only vote for it if she quit straight after. May is basically now the unpopular kid in school who the teachers have told you you have to be nice to. Sure, we'll go see the film you want to see if you make sure you never ever hang out with me ever again afterwards, as I just don't want to see your collection of insect legs that you keep in your pocket. Weirdo. But even without those obstacles, Speaker and Hedgehog John Bercow has ruled that May can't have a meaningful vote 3 if her deal hasn't changed substantially, which means she's probably aiming to change the font and title, as well as do some of it in coloured ink and the rest in memes. So, an extension maybe, except the EU have to agree to that, and the chief Brexit negotiator and former host of Pebble Mill, Michel Barnier, says there's no majority in the EU for extending Article 50, but I'm guessing May will try to go ahead, even if only 52% of them are keen. It seems dismembered eel penis Nigel Farage, and what if Martin Kemp was a fascist, Andy Wigmore, have been trying to persuade the far-right Italian party Lega Nord to block any extensions. Which is odd, as I thought those two are very much against foreign interference from Europe into British sovereignty. But if the EU agreed to it and an extension did happen, well, it looks like it could mean the Brexit date is pushed back to June the 30th, which would be ideal, as that's International Asteroid Day, meaning we can all spend it wishing for something to crash into us before we crash out. Speaking of Farage, which is sadly something that happens far too often for a man that I really believe should be placed in a deep well and only occasionally remembered so that people can shout echoey swear words into it, the March for Leave, which he promoted, started on Saturday. If started is the right word for a handful of shuffling angry idiots making their way through the rain like a zombie horde absolutely struggling to find brains. Only 350 people signed up, with less actually attending, and Farage said that he wouldn't be going for the whole thing because everything he does is a metaphor for everything he does. I was actually expecting him to vanish 5 minutes after the start, before handing over to slapped arse-cheek Paul Nuttall, who'd then tell everyone he completed 567 ultra-marathons already, so this would be piss-easy, before Farage kept scoping in just to tell everyone how much it had gone to shit now he'd left. Red to crap opinion, Isabel Oakeshott said on Twitter that numbers were limited for security, and that Leave Means Leave were overwhelmed with offers, proving that despite it being their core support, they still can't spot bots. I'm pretty certain that by overwhelmed she actually did mean 4 spam emails, someone wanting to bring their dog, and a sex bot that they invited, but then it blocked them. Pictures that I've seen of the event make it very hard to distinguish whether it's a very poorly attended rally or a very well-attended meat raffle. Anyway, good luck to them, as nothing will thin out the ardent no-deal bunch if a second referendum occurs, quite like making all those oldies walk through the rain for several days. In other news, because somehow there is some, Deputy Labour leader and face on toast Tom Watson has set up the Future Britain group for Labour MPs who want to stay in the party but feel disillusioned, so want to join something that sounds like if Britain First worked out how to use electricity. Lord and Prince of Snarkness, Peter Mandelson, said the first meeting of 130 MPs represented a coming together of the TBGBs, which is his phrase for followers of Blair and Brown, but I think sounds a lot more like the heebie-jeebies, which similarly makes many feel uncomfortable despite being outdated. Aforementioned twat Boris Johnson said on streaming Bile radio site LBC that police spending on historic child sexual abuse allegations was being spaffed up a wall, which many are angry about him saying, but I think it could have been a compliment, as he was just referring to a much-loved game that he played with his housemasters at Eton. And lastly, Lib Dem leader and farmer bean Vince Cable is stepping down from his prime position in May. There's no clue as to who will replace him yet, but sources say possible contenders for this ever-diminishing party are either a plain digestive, a pair of khaki slacks, or the band Maroon 5. I'm ill. Can you hear it? It's horrible, isn't it? It's probably quite horrible to listen to. I'm full of chest cough horrors, and I'd be honest, in any other normal week, I'd record a 5-minute cough-filled apology to say I'm skipping this week of podcast in order to hack up my lungs off mic somewhere, but I couldn't leave you all this week, could I? What with all the votes that ultimately don't really mean anything, and all the debates where everyone said things and absolutely didn't follow through with them? I mean, how could I abandon you this week when we all know that without this podcast, you'd still be in the know just as much as if you hadn't heard it, didn't watch the news, and lived on the moon. Ah, just imagine the peace and quiet of living on the moon, eh? Sure, it'd be cold and have no atmosphere, but that's not that different to a lot of offices that I've previously worked in, with the difference being that they were full of people that I didn't like, so actually the moon is definitely better. Anyway, there's loads of news bits that I've missed on this week's show because of illness. Turns out that having a chest cold thing makes it very hard to try and find any humour in subjects like the former Lib Dem leader being suspended because he knew about Cyril Smith's paedophilia. Comedy! There's no comedy in that. Got nothing about all the social media stuff, but on the other hand, I also had no space to put the Anna Soubry as like if, while driving in the rain, you accidentally caught Robert Smith from The Cure in your headlights. I mean, how long should a podcast be? Tricky, isn't it? If a podcast is played in the forest and all the squirrels try to eat your smartphone, does it count as a listen? Look, all I'm saying is this week's show is what it is, and after I've stopped recording, I'm going to down a bottle of Bronco Stop. That's the cough syrup I'm on at the moment. Actually, I'm mixing cough syrups at the moment. I'm on Benylin and Bronco Stop. And Bronco Stop really sounds like I should be able to sip it and then maybe fight an angry bull, but actually it just makes me cough a lot and then feel sad. I demand a more appropriate name. How about a bottle of cough sadness? Perfect. Anyway, thanks to you for being here, or wherever you are. I mean, you're not all here. That'd be awful for you, as you'd catch whatever this is that I have, and then you'd cough through the show too and miss a lot of bits. Or, if you timed it right, cough when I cough, and then you wouldn't miss things, except you would, because all the coughs will be edited out, so you'll still miss things. But all I'm saying is that I'm glad you're not here, you know, for your sake, in the nicest way. But yes, same old admin stuff, except that I'm ill. So, quicker, you know, if you want to donate to the ko-fi.com/parboilbro or patreon.com/parboilbro, then it'll save you buying me grapes, flowers, or a card telling me that I have man flu and to shut up. Or you could review the show, and I won't even mind if you write your derogatory thoughts about my obvious man flu on some iTunes comments, if you also give the show 5 stars. I'm that shallow, I won't care. And I'm ill, and it would definitely make me feel better. Definitely, absolutely would. Or, you know, just tell people to listen in. This show gets a very nice amount of listeners, but what would really get rid of my cough, as doctors definitely agree, would be having even more listeners, like hundreds of thousands, if possible. I mean, if it got millions, then chances are I'd never get ill again. I'm just saying, think about it, and if you don't think about it, then I'll assume you're some sort of cruel Dr. Death type who revels in others' sadness, and frankly, that means we can't be friends anyway. Though I suppose, even if we were, I wouldn't want you here, so sort of redundant. Other admin stuff for this week includes the Kids Politics Show, what I do with Tutton at Simple Politics, called How Does This Politics Thing Work Then? It is next at the Pound Arts Centre in Corsham on March the 30th, which could have been the day after Brexit, but now might not be, but now might also be. Why not bring your children aged 6 plus to laugh at exactly how on earth we've rewritten things last minute? It's a 2 p.m. start, and you can find tickets at poundarts.org.uk. Hopefully, I won't have coughed myself to death by then. Then, something that I won't be at, so my health status doesn't really matter anyway. Could have coughed myself to death. Who will care? It doesn't matter. This brilliant charity comedy night in aid of women and children first is going to go ahead anyway. And that's a charity that supports women, children, mothers and babies in the poorest communities around the world. The show's at the Leicester Square Theatre on the 13th of May, and it's got comedians such as Josh Widdicombe, Kerry Godliman, John Robbins, Laura Lex Beckhill and Dane Baptiste, among loads of other good'uns. And he's going to be brilliant, and I'm gutted that I couldn't be part of it, as I'm otherwise engaged / dead from coughing to death. But do grab tickets from the Leicester Square Theatre website or womenandchildrenfirst.org.uk/comedy. And lastly, assuming I survive this week, there might be a little podcast gap in early April, because I'll be dead from coughing, but also that's when I'm moving flat, and knowing the wonders of the internet, I probably won't have any, as it'll require a man to come round and patronisingly show me how to plug in a router that I'll already have plugged in or something. That's what always happens. So hopefully nothing will happen early April anyway, and then it won't really matter. I'm sure it'll be fine. The news will be quiet. I mean, you know, look, hey, if something really stupid happens, I'll find a coffee shop with free Wi-Fi and just yell in the corner for 5 minutes and then load it up so you're not completely alone. Deal? Deal. On this week's show, there is Hazel Sheffield and Gareth Davis from the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, all about their report on local councils selling off all their public assets to pay for staff redundancies. Yes, that's right, it does sound bleak. Comedy! Plus, I'm going to attempt to explain last week's Brexit votes, even though ultimately it doesn't really mean anything. But I guess, does anything mean anything, apart from my awful cough and the likelihood that I'm mere minutes away from hacking up at least one vital organ? Thanks for your obvious sympathy. Right, let's start with some of this. The problem with the spring statement being nestled in amongst all the Brexit voting is that no one really cared or had time to care what Philip Hammond announced. He could have said, I've bet all our money on a pig race, Count Oinkula for the win. And I reckon there's a chance it would have got through under all the noise of no deals and extensions. And hey, that makes sense, right? Because what is the point in putting in a ton of hard effort and then we thunk out of the EU without a deal and all the money spent using, I don't know, rockets to bring potatoes over from Estonia or training seagulls to deliver pottery to Sicily? And to be honest, if you had paid attention to the statement, then there wasn't a lot in there to particularly float the economic boat anyway. There was a whole, hey, aren't we doing well chat about the economy because the government will be borrowing less next year than the Office for Budget Responsibility predicted, which means we're now at a 10-year low for borrowing, which is great, but that doesn't quite balance out with the lack of specific funding for social care or the benefit freeze, which is continuing for at least another year. So hooray, you know, all well and good that the government don't need to borrow money, but it feels a lot like they're saying that as a way to punish their naughty kids. Oh no, they don't need ice cream, they'll be just fine, you know, as one of them keels over with low blood sugar. Hammond promised £100 million for police overtime to tackle knife crime, which is a bit weird. I mean, why would you want police overtime rather than, you know, more police officers? I can't imagine the best people to chase after teenagers with knives is a knackered, underpaid officer. Also, as was mentioned on last week's show, it's not just police that need extra funding in order to deal with knife crime, so this feels a bit like spending for dummies. Okay, so knife crime, give the police some money, what next? Unemployment? Cool. Buy the job centre 5 new chairs. Done. And then what? Poverty? Oh, here's 5 chocolate coins for everyone. Yeah, idiots. There's a £3 billion affordable home scheme to build 30,000 new homes that will fall under the not actually affordable bracket, and it'll still leave them short of their annual housing targets. £800 million is going towards an increase in non-NHS spending, which I guess is a nice way of saying that's all we're putting into absolutely everything else. And there was no mention of the current crisis in funding that councils are suffering from. 2 years ago in the March budget, it was announced that there would be a green paper on social care with a public consultation and a look into funding for it. Yet here we are, 2019, and still nothing. You know, unless it's so green that it's had something else superimposed onto it the whole time. Phil, is that the green paper you've made to look like the really bored MPs behind you? Oh, and yeah, Hammond did promise free sanitary products in schools to end period poverty, but that only ends it if you're at school. I mean, what about the holidays? What about women in poverty who are too old to go to school? And what about, you know, just stopping poverty? It feels a bit like telling people who can't afford to feed their babies that it's okay, every nursery will have some tuck biscuits there, so that's that, job done. But as the Chancellor said, none of this will happen if Brexit goes without a deal anyway. And if there is some amazing deal that appears and fixes everything, then hey, there's a whole £26.6 billion he can add into the budget. Which is nice, as Brexit has cost the UK £40 billion so far, according to the Bank of England. God, I wish I could work like that. You know, tell my landlord that this month I'm paying him a two-thirds increase on last month's rent, despite his protest that last month I only paid an eighth of what I should. Don't worry, I'll also be putting a fat sum of cash onto my credit card, which won't remotely make up for blitzing it all over the last 3 years. Still, I can slightly sympathise with old Phil. I mean, imagine putting a whole load of hard work in something, and then bloody Brexit has the potential to ruin it within days. Try doing a podcast, Hammond. You'll see. You'll bloody see. If you listen to episode 133, the Chris Grayling special, which fittingly, according to listening stats, several of you failed to do, then you'll have heard me talk about the lack of funding in councils. I mean, there just isn't any. So how on earth are they meant to deal with the bins and whatever else it is they're meant to do? In the spring statement last week, Philip Hammond didn't even mention the £5 billion funding black hole that local councils are going to have to deal with by 2020. Now, some of you, like me, may have had a council tax letter through your door recently that said it had an extra increase in order to fund adult social care. And hey, look, I'm more than happy to support my local community needs, but it does kind of smart when that's mainly just because the government wants to spend it all on fridges for Matt Hancock to buy instead. But social care is just one of the areas councils are struggling with funding for, and some of their methods for dealing with this cash depletion are a bit odd. For example, the recent Sold From Under You report, which sounds like it's about the time I sat on an auction item at the Antiques Roadshow, but it's actually about the 12,000 council properties that have been sold off in order to pay for staff redundancies. Yes, you've no longer got a youth centre because some people in food safety had to go. There's no winner in that sentence. You've lost out, they've lost out. It's the financial policy equivalent of listening to this podcast. So I dropped a line to the authors of that very report, and luckily two of them, Hazel Sheffield and Gareth Davis, got back to me and said they were very happy to tell me all about how bad things are for councils, why they're selling off everything, and exactly what the third bin I have does, because I'm really not sure, and I'm starting to think it's just for unwanted guests. Okay, I didn't ask them that last one. Oh, and
Excuses!
This isn't the best recording sound-wise, I say to you with my voice that isn't the best for recording sound-wise. I spoke to Hazel and Gareth on their mobiles at the same time because technology is amazing. But also, as you'll hear, or maybe not hear if you're listening on a train or while piloting a plane or driving a tank, it's not that amazing. I have tested it on a few people, and by that I mean my wife and daughter, the latter of whom just really wasn't bothered and kept trying to eat her own foot. So I think it should be okay, but if it isn't, then please do type me an email and then delete it before you send it and go do something useful. Thanks. Here's Hazel and Gareth. Hi, Gareth and Hazel. You have done quite an extensive report into the selling off of public property by councils. What prompted you to investigate it in, I mean, to such an extent? I think it was 12,000 properties you investigated, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I was running a project called Pioneer Resistance about 2016, looking at community solutions, which is kind of the other side of this, when communities have to step in and fill in the gaps from public services retreating. And over the course of that project, I was aware that there was this huge gap in my reporting, which is what was actually happening at local councils. So I think I first got in touch with Gareth in 2016. I'd always been a huge fan of Fura Local and the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, and I asked him if he would be up for looking into this as a line of inquiry.
So it made sense for us because for the sort of previous 12 months, we've been doing very data-led investigation into the state of local council finances, or predicting which councils, using publicly available data, could we predict which councils were under the most financial pressure and which ones would follow in the footsteps of Northamptonshire, which was the first in nearly 20 years to effectively go bankrupt. So it worked, it tied in really well with that because we'd done the top level figures, but what we really wanted to do was look at an impact of these funding cuts, and this is a really good example of it.
And just out of interest, from that early data, what sort of, you know, obviously we heard about Northamptonshire on the news, that was quite a big story at the time. How many councils were you seeing go that way? What was the data showing you before you even started this investigation?
We were showing about 20, 30 councils heading in the same direction or sharing similar signs of financial distress as Northamptonshire. None at that point the same level, but it also highlighted that there were, of those councils that were under the biggest pressure, all of them were county councils, because there's a particular pressure within that structure of local government, as Northamptonshire is a county council. So that was the big kind of new thing that jumped out, that was that county councils were in particular trouble.
And so did you have any idea of the extent that you would then discover that things were being sold off by councils, and then especially then you found in order to fund staff redundancy? So, I mean, was it far more widespread than you'd imagined?
Well, with the redundancies angle, this has all come about from the period of research that me and Hazel did ahead of submitting the FOIs, because it's a really important process to make sure that, one, the information you're asking for isn't already available online or elsewhere, and two, that, you know, you make sure that your FOIs are as accurate as possible. So when you're, basically that means that your reporting is more accurate, and what you don't want to have is 6 months down the line an issue to come up with the way you've worded the FOI, which kind of undermines the story. And in terms of when we're doing that research, I found a couple of very prominent examples of councils who'd spent the money from selling assets, public spaces, on funding redundancies. And I thought, well, that struck me as we kind of worded it, which is sort of double blow to communities because they're losing public spaces and they're losing jobs. And it just really curious as to the extent to which that was happening elsewhere. And it happened that it wasn't just those couple, it was almost 40 councils were doing it.
Forgive me as well if this is an obvious question to an extent, but what has led to councils having to do this? I mean, I presume that austerity is a large chunk of it and cuts, but is there more to it than that?
That is obviously the overarching cause, without a doubt, but it's also the other things where councils are restricted in the ways in which they can actually raise money. They can't raise council tax beyond a certain point without a public referendum. Some councils are going to be limited in terms of raising money from business rates because they have less businesses in their local authority area, and as a result, they lobbied the government for greater freedom to use the money from assets towards basically propping up their budgets, and they were given that power. And I think if you give councils that are sort of in a desperate situation that ability, some of them will take advantage of that.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think it's well known now that how much of the government grant to councils has been lost now. Councils have lost around 60% of their funding from the government. And next year, half of the councils in England are going to lose funding from central government entirely. And obviously this puts them, in dire straits. They need to find ways to fund basic services at this point, caring for the elderly, transportation, libraries, community centres, all those sorts of things. So the change that came about in 2016 was this change to this ruling on flexible use of capital receipts. George Osborne decided to allow councils to use the money from selling buildings to start funding changes to services. They couldn't use it to plug budgets directly, but they could use it to fund changes or transformations of services, and redundancies counted as part of that. And that's how you get this kind of result where councils are using the proceeds to, I guess, for redundancy packages for their most expensive staff.
And, I mean, what are the effects of selling off all these buildings? Because they're needing to cover costs and kind of cover areas like social care where they can, but surely selling off some of these buildings affects people that needed them, that would have come under areas of social care. I mean, doesn't it have a kind of cyclical detrimental effect across the board?
Yeah, I mean, I think both in both Gareth and my reporting, we talked to people whose lives have been seriously affected by the sell-off of these buildings. You're not talking just about, you know, bricks and mortar. Suddenly there's, you know, a community centre that's in private hands rather than public hands. These buildings have had access changes, you know, care homes or adult daycare centres I was looking into, and suddenly the lights have gone out, you know, and people who needed adult social care in the day were having to find alternative provisions. Parents were setting up services, or people were spending more time with elderly relatives because they didn't have care homes to go to. And I know Gareth spoke to some people who had been moved up, a boxing club who'd been moved on twice. I don't know if you want to talk about that, Gareth.
Yeah, I think the point that jumped out to me was that in kind of a lot of cases, these places that were being sold off had been closed already. And for some local authorities and the local government association, they were very keen to make that point that, oh, well, we're not, you know, these things are, you know, not used anymore. But the reason why they weren't used is because they were already, you know, the services that were based in them had been closed due to funding cuts. And it's very much, as you said, it is a cyclical nature. So, you know, back in 2010-11, funding, the austerity agenda began, and gradually since then, councils have had more and more of their funding taken away, and as a result, services have closed. And due to that, the buildings those services were connected to go unused, and therefore councils feel empowered and able to sell them off, then to also fund further service cuts and reductions in funding, which will inevitably lead to, again, more buildings and public spaces being unused, and they will be sold off, and eventually the councils will be down to the bare bones. And it isn't a long-term sustainable, even if councils are doing this responsibly and by the rules, it's not a long-term sustainable policy to sell off assets to balance your budget, because eventually you run out of assets. And what's needed is a fundamental change in the way councils are funded, which includes a massive, you know, an increase to a certainly sort of pre-2014-13 levels, if not higher.
But Hazel, I think you mentioned earlier that from 2020, that even more are going to have their budgets cut. So, and I think there's not much. I think it's quite hazy as to where funding's going to be coming from after 2020 for most councils, isn't it?
Well, the reliance is going to be on. Sorry, carry on.
No, you go ahead.
Well, the idea is that councils will become effectively self-funding because of business rates. So instead of giving a portion of their business rates over to the central government, they'll be retaining all of it. But obviously that one, it's taken them a long time just to roll out even the pilot projects of that particular policy. And two, that obviously benefits some councils way more than it does others, because it depends on your business rate base and basically the kind of prominence and of the number of businesses in your area. The fewer you have, the less you can actually raise money that way. What they're consulting on other changes, but again, it all seems that it doesn't involve an injection of new money. It involves a redistribution of money, and however that system works, someone will lose out.
Yeah, I think you can sort of, you get a clue to what's going to happen to councils when you look at something like Northamptonshire, where you can see that it's kind of shrunk so much now. It's almost become just an agency for commercial services. It's cut its core staff from thousands just to 150. It's got these four commercial bodies who are responsible for child protection, vulnerable adults, health and improvements. And I wonder if we'll see more councils just kind of shrinking so that they're an agency for commercial services rather than actually being able to provide them themselves.
And I mean, you mentioned Northamptonshire again there. Why have we not seen that happen with more councils? Is it because they've been rapidly selling things off before they can, you know, was Northamptonshire kind of a warning signal that caused this to happen more rapidly?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I just got my letter, my council tax receipt from Camden Council yesterday, and it says, you know, we are now reaching a tipping point. I think that's definitely the start of we're going to, as the government grant falls to zero, we're going to start seeing the effects of this much more widely. Gareth did some incredible reporting on Peterborough that showed that already councils are using the same sorts of illegal, potentially illegal practices to kind of make their budgets work that Northamptonshire was doing before it went bust.
And how many, the one thing we haven't touched on is how many job losses have there been from all these staff redundancies that are being paid for? That must be having quite an effect on the areas as well, because councils hire quite a lot of people.
I mean, it's quite difficult because of the transparency issue. My spend on redundancy that comes from the sale of public assets to the number of redundancies. We do know, for example, in Bristol, in the year before this policy was used, there were 39 redundancies. In the year after, they used around about £5 million of money raised from asset sales to fund redundancies. Those numbers of redundancies increased to 401, so it's more than a tenfold increase. But because councils will tell you you can't connect exactly the sum of money from a particular sale to a particular policy, we just know that one generally was used to fund the other. It's quite difficult. What we did from our study is that we know that there were more than, since 2014-15, there have been more than 75,000 redundancies in local authorities across the country. And it's, that has huge impacts obviously on local communities, but on the way councils are run, that has connections with the privatisation, the outsourcing of public services, and whether that affects quality. And there's huge kind of other things that to explore just with that issue.
Yeah, 75,000 is an awful lot of people. That's really, and that's just from the councils that got back to you as well. Because I know you had several that didn't respond to the Freedom of Information request. So,
well, that's pretty much 100%. That one. There were two sets of FOIs, and we didn't get where some councils in that particular FOI refused to tell us that information. I got that information from their accounts. So. That's pretty much 100%.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And we'll be back with Hazel and Gareth in a minute, but first...
Brexit fallout! Brexit fallout! Brexit fallout!
It feels necessary to do one of these this week, but what can I tell you that will still be relevant within a few days? Well, the easy answer is, it'll still be exhausting and shit, and whatever happens, that's going to be true. You're welcome. The hard answer, though, well, there's a lot of those, and I thought it might be useful to do a shouty quick answer decomplication session, which is my snappy title for what will happen now.
What happened last week?
Loads, but also not loads. May's deal got rejected again, but not as harshly, but still harshly. And all of this feels like she can swap the deal for my teenage love life, and it would kind of be the same. Although, if that is true, I suggest she gets a deal that involves being part of the school play, because that really worked a treat. And then, the next night, having no deal under any arrangement, got rejected too. Even though the Conservatives had whipped their lot to vote against it, but they didn't listen because no one likes May. But that wasn't...
Oi!
What?
Why did some Conservatives talk down no deal and then vote for it?
Ah, well, because of one of the amendments on the rejecting a no-deal motion was the Spellman Amendment, which sounds like it incorporates a really boring education-based superhero into proceedings. But what it actually did was remove the date of March 29th from the government's wording. Originally, if the motion had been voted for, it would have meant no deal was off the table for the upcoming Brexit date. But with the Spellman Amendment, then it means it's off for any date and whatever happens, which means MPs aren't as pressured to vote for May's deal again. Except they are, as it's not a legally binding arrangement. So basically, it's still a big old pay attention to my feelings signifier and a nice smack in the chops for El Governamento, who lost yet another vote. Slam.
What was the Mothouse Amendment thingy? Isn't he a character in The Simpsons?
No, that's Milhouse, idiot. The Malthouse Amendment was really stupid and basically involved going to the EU with our own backstop that we'd managed that wasn't possible and then having a sort of managed no deal that also isn't possible. And look, it was just stupid. It was really stupid and no one liked it and it got rejected, so who cares? And hey, none of that was legally binding anyway, so it could still be a no deal if no one agrees a deal. Yes, that is some of your life that you'll never ever get back.
And then what happened?
Then Labour leader and distressed human fleece Jeremy Corbyn said, well, we have to extend Article 50 now, even though he's one of the people who said it should be triggered immediately 2 years ago and that the vote on delaying Article 50 was going to happen anyway. So really, why didn't he just shout, you're all dickheads, and then do a dance, as ultimately it would have been the same result, only he'd actually have gained popularity. So then there was a vote on extending Article 50 and the amendment for a second referendum got voted down. Labour members were whipped to abstain against it and some, like Ruth Smith, resigned just to avoid the whip, but so she could vote against it. God, isn't it all so weird? But it would have lost anyway as no one wants another referendum yet, even the second referendum people, who also abstained on their own amendment because they realised no one likes them either. Then Hillary Benn's amendment for Parliament to shout fuck this shit and snatch Brexit off May and try and do it properly, that lost by just two votes. Two votes, ZOMG WTF BBQ. Then Labour's amendment was for Parliament to find time to find an approach that wasn't May's deal, but that was rejected by a majority of 16 because they don't want May's deal, but they also don't not want May's deal. And anyway, the government motion did pass, which meant multi-wins for the government, which they were happy with because they don't win anything anymore because cheaters never win. And anyway, none of that's legally binding either, so what is the actual fucking point?
And why did Brexit Secretary and human cotton bud Stephen Bartley give a closing speech for the need for an extension then vote against it?
Mainly because he's an idiot. I mean, he also says the closing argument was to make sure people voted against Ben's deal, and then because Conservative ministers had a free vote for the main motion, he didn't want anyone to frustrate the process, even though he doesn't seem to understand any process, and everyone's frustrated now the Brexit Secretary isn't voting in line with the Prime Minister anymore, though to be fair, it's not like he does anything anyway.
So then May was going to bring back a meaningful vote on her deal three, right?
Yes, and she spent all week trying to butter up Tory rebels who all told her, OK, I'll vote for it, but only if you resign immediately afterwards, which feels like it probably wasn't the answer May wanted. I mean, imagine being a door-to-door salesperson like that. Will you buy this series of books? Sure, but only if you drop dead as soon as I make the purchase. May and Hammond have also been having meetings with the DUP to get them to accept May's deal, which they didn't agree to because they were too busy looking like they needed to disapprove of the fact that you smiled about something. The plan was either for May to bring back her vote this week before she went to the EU Leaders Summit, where they'd all have fine ways not to sit next to her at lunch in case she started telling them about her deal that was all new again, or she'd meet EU leaders and ask for an extension with no reason to ask for an extension, then bring back her vote next week, which would be stupid if there was an extension. And yes, all of this again is really, it's really stupid.
But
today, Speaker John Bercow made a surprise announcement where he brought up a 400-year-old law that was all about MPs not being allowed to repeat a motion within the same session if it was the same or very similar to a previous motion. And basically, I would usually rail against how out of touch our parliament is, but then suddenly it's all about a 400-year-old law and I'm like, damn, I'm back and the HOC is great. The motion is from Erskine May, which isn't a relation to Theresa May, but actually the most authoritative reference book on parliamentary procedure. So yes, pretty much the opposite of the Prime Minister in every way. Authoritative, referential, and a book, as opposed to a metallic clunk machine. The Number 10 spokesperson took over 4 hours to respond, but when they eventually did, they said, this is something that requires proper consideration, which means May will leave it till last minute and then just bring back her deal again without any changes. So now she's got to go to the EU Leaders Summit and still ask for an extension, and there won't be a reason why, other than that no one can decide on what they want to do.
Would the EU give the UK an extension anyway?
Possibly not. Michel Barnier said there's not a unanimous consensus to do so at the moment. Plus, right-wing idiots Nigel Farage and Andy Wigmore, among others, say they've been telling the far-right half of the Italian coalition government to block it, and other Eurosceptics have been lobbying Polish and Hungarian parliaments too. So I'm guessing an extension to at least June the 30th is likely, which is what May wants, and the EU says it'll terminate the UK's membership by July the 1st if they don't hold European elections, which have to take place between May the 23rd and May the 26th. But EU President and Amalgamation of Hellboy and an Egg, Donald Tusk, says he'll advise members that Britain may need a long period to rethink its approach. So they might insist on an extension of, say, 2 years, which probably still won't be enough, because what will happen is everyone will just argue for 2 more years and then May will bring back exactly the same deal just in, I don't know, 2021.
A long extension's needed, right?
Yeah, except there's worries that a longer extension would mean all the other EU countries would demand more things, you know, like Spain wanting more rights over Gibraltar and further limits over the UK's influence over EU laws that we'll have to be subject to. And while I kind of think, well, it serves us right, I also never like the idea of being the only ones not having a say in a democracy. Oh, and businesses, of course, will generally be losing their shit at all the different end dates. Apparently, Transport Secretary and insomnia personified Chris Grayling faces a potential bill of £28 million just to renegotiate his ferry contract, which currently only covers an exit date of March the 29th. But let's be fair, Grayling could lose £28 million down the back of a sofa that didn't have any cushions and was actually a large dog that had never even seen a sofa before. So really, doesn't make much difference. And of course, by the time you hear all of that could be wrong. Helpful?
No!
You're welcome. And now, back to Hazel and Gareth.
And are you finding that people, because I know that you've got the Sold From Under You hashtag that you've been using on Twitter and ask people to share stories, and obviously, Hazel, you've got your Far Nearer project as well. But are you finding that people are aware of this? Because I sort of fairly have noticed that it's not really been in the news very much. Obviously, Brexit has dominated pretty much everything. But are people noticing that their spaces are disappearing, apart from the people that actively use, you know, specific ones?
I think we all know, even if it's not being in... if it's not in the press every day, I think we all know that what our public services are lacking or what's changed, you know. I think even if you know your council tax is going up, you know you have to wait longer to see a doctor, you know, if school funding is changing, for example. But I think what the investigation does for the first time is shows exactly the number of public spaces that have been lost, certainly. And through that, you're able to tell stories of the people that have been directly affected by buildings being lost.
Sure. What sort of, I mean, you were mentioning obviously earlier some the boxing gym and place that have been closed as well. What other sort of stuff are you hearing about other? I mean, I'll tell you a very personal one. I'm in Haringey, and our town hall has just been sold off, which is where I got married a couple of years ago. So I'm personally very sad about it. But it's being turned into a luxury hotel with a very small amount of workspace and social space compared to what they were promising. And are you finding a lot? There must be a lot of personal stories like that.
The interesting thing about that particular sale, actually, is the council didn't include that in their information.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, we've got a reporter there who's very curious. She's done a load of stuff in Haringey. She used to work as a local reporter there, and she was very confused to find that when she looked at the data, that particular sale wasn't on there. And it turns out the council had mysteriously left that one off the FOI, which seems slightly strange, given it's probably the most prominent thing that they've done.
Oh, wow. It sort of showed up in our local elections. Things sort of changed as a result of the last council selling off quite a lot of things. So people kind of made their voices heard then, but then it got blamed on various other electoral reasons. And it was very interesting. But I wonder if you're getting a lot more kind of... you must be getting quite a lot of personal stories like that, because public spaces, I think people don't realise how important they are and what role they've played in people's lives, you know.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the beauty of working with the VRA Local. Like, their network is... hundreds of journalists who are all able to access this data and start looking into like the way that communities have been affected by this. So certainly I've really enjoyed learning about, well, enjoyed is maybe the wrong word, but I found it really interesting to read the reporting of all the local press that have got involved on this.
Yeah, I bet. And one of the places I've read about recently was Preston Council, which is doing something called Guerrilla Localism, which is trying to outsource things. Just, well, I say it's not outsourcing, it's getting workers in from its very local area in a way to sustain itself and keep working there. Do you think that's a way forward for is that one of the methods that could save things in the future?
Yeah, I've done lots of reporting in Preston, actually. I think Preston would be, Preston Council certainly are the first people to say that what they're doing isn't going to replace the budget cuts. And, you know, they agreed their budget, I think it was last week, or the week before, and they're in exactly the same situation as everybody else. You know, they're losing their central government grants, they're struggling to afford their basic services, And really what they've done successfully is to start thinking about ways that the council can build partnerships with other civic bodies in the city, like the university, police, different colleges, and thinking about ways that they can kind of incubate what wealth that they have. They're doing that through cooperatives, so worker-owned businesses, so rather than the profits of any kind of business leaving the city, they're trying to keep more wealth within Preston itself, but they're also thinking about really interesting ideas like setting up a regional bank so that they can provide credit lines to people so they don't have to get payday loans and to support more local businesses. So yeah, definitely there's some cities that are working on these kind of community wealth building ideas that, while they're not definitely not a solution to the council funding crisis, they are, I think, they're coming out of this need for alternative thinking and innovative ideas, and it'll be really interesting to see what comes of that.
Sure, yeah, I guess it's going to, it depends on where you live and if your council's kind of keen to progress with something like that. I mean, if you, I know that on the bottom of your report as well, you're talking about Save Our Public Spaces and campaigns like that. What can people do if they are worried about spaces that are under threat? What's the, I mean, is there anything, do the local community have any power in this at the moment?
I mean, they, you know, there are various mechanisms that are supposed to be set up that should empower or at least give communities greater opportunity to take over the running of council, sort of council-owned spaces when a council wants to sell them off. We know that from the research done by a locality, which is in a sort of an umbrella group that represents that sort of community groups, that there isn't a wide enough kind of take-up of these particular rules for various reasons. And I think that the concern that I would have, and I think they've echoed, is that this particular power that came into place in 2016 that enabled councils to use the money they get from selling assets to put towards their running costs, de-incentivizes councils from transferring things to the community, because obviously that for the most part will not generate them a capital receipt, which is the sort of name for the money they get from selling them off. And if you don't get that money, you can't use that for service reform to reduce costs over the long term. So I think there's a contradiction here in that you've got this policy on the one hand, it does encourage councils to sell to the private sector for as much money as possible, and the desire for people to actually take over the running of these spaces and so to keep them in community use.
I mean, is there any indication at government level that there's any interest in changing these policies? I mean, I assume, again, everything's so full of Brexit at the moment that it's being generally ignored. Or have you heard of any kind of wiggle room or any interest from any ministers?
I don't think so, because for years the local government association lobbied for these changes. They wanted to, I mean, previously the idea that you could only, the rule that you could only spend the money from selling an asset on effectively other assets was a kind of foundation stone of local authority finances. Councils wanted to change that because they wanted to use they felt that the decisions of how those assets should be, what should happen to them should be made locally, and they wanted to use that money to effectively prop up their budgets. I think there would be, you know, a strong opposition from councils and the local government association, and there are, you know, this government, the Conservative government, is far more in tow to what the district councils, their shire members, want than is ideal. And I think there would be they'd be very reluctant to go back to the old system. These current rules run till 2021, and I wouldn't be surprised to see them extended beyond that, because I think the councils like them. But I think what we need to do as journalists, as members of the public, is to have more information and more transparent system where we can decide for ourselves and the public can decide whether these decisions are right or not, because I think that at the moment they are really being denied a lot of the key facts that would arm them with, you know, making that decision.
One of the problems with the assets of community value that Gareth was talking about earlier is that communities, if they want to protect a building, a community space from being sold for the by a council, they have to register it as an asset of community value. So they have to, for example, your town hall, they would have had to say before the council showed any interest in selling it, oh, we value this space, we want to register it as this asset of community value, it's called. And then it goes on a register. So if the council decides to sell it, it has to first ask the community, oh, we're going to sell this building, are you interested in buying it? But of course, the councils have no obligation to tell the community if they're going to sell any other building. If it's not on this register, they can go about their business and get rid of these assets, really kind of under the radar, hence the name of the investigation. And the community has no kind of recourse. Once their wheels are in motion, it's very unlikely that they're able to raise as much money as a developer or a private company to fight to keep that building in community or even public ownership, you know.
So in I'm very aware that nearly all the interviews I ever do for this podcast end quite sort of bleakly like that, which is because of the state things are, which is very sad. So I just wonder if you have anyone anywhere that you could recommend people check out or get involved with, or what can people do now, or what would you advise that people do now if they're interested in saving public space, or at least interested in knowing more about what can be done.
Well, this is the locality website that we linked to through the Social Monday map. They have loads of information about how communities can register assets as assets of community value, which is kind of the first step to protecting them. Anyone else you'd recommend, Gareth?
Well, I'd say, on the other hand, also, if they're just interested in what's going on in their local community and they might want to take part in kind of supporting local journalism, that they could, it would be great if they would sign up to the Bureau Local Network. Just find, Google Bureau Local, click on that page, and there'll be a link to join the network there. And that's, even if they don't, if they just have just a little bit of curiosity about how investigations are done, it could be, we'd be more than welcome to come along.
Many thanks to Hazel and Gareth. You can find the Sold From Under You report on the Bureau of Investigative Journalism's website at thebureauinvestigates.com, where you can find the link to the Bureau Local too, and I'll pop the link in the podcast info as well. Huffington Post have done a summary on their site too, and Hazel can be found on Twitter at Hazel Sheffield. Her website with links to her journalism and filmmaking is hazelsheffield.com, and one of her main projects, Far Nearer, about local projects and people building economic resilience in the UK, is at farnearer.org or on Twitter at far_nearer. Gareth is on Twitter at Gareth_Davis, that's IES09, and you can find links to his works at the aforementioned Bureau of Investigative Journalism site. I'm getting some lovely suggestions from you lot as to who to interview at the moment, and as always, not all of them reply to my very almost begging-like emails asking to interview them. So I still need more suggestions, please. Do I need someone who can update on something this podcast has covered before? What other new subjects to ask someone about? Who can this show give a voice to that needs one, albeit a small voice that's often badly recorded? All thoughts welcomed. I'd love to get someone on to talk about defence, if you know or follow anyone who can do that and isn't a weird, war-loving bellend. My current basic research shows that this is quite hard to do, so please, please enlighten me if that's not the case. But I'm open to all suggestions except between 12 and 1 p.m. when I'm closed for lunch. So please do contact me at Parpolbro on Twitter, the Partly Political Broadcast group on Facebook, the contact page at partlypoliticalbroadcast.co.uk, or email me at partlypoliticalbroadcast@gmail.com. That is really hard to say when you've got a chesty cough. The last two options also end up in the same inbox. Ha! I've had you all fooled all along. Or, of course, you could write it in a note that you hide along a dirt track through a field and somewhere along a ridiculously long stone wall, pop it under a particular stone in a box beneath some soil. But then chances are Morgan Freeman will find it first, and while he'll read it in a better voice than I would, he'd probably just be a bit confused and overall disappointed. All in all, as always, it's probably just best to email. And that's it for this week's Partly Political Broadcast, and as it probably sounds like, my voice. Thank you for sticking with this horrible-sounding episode. And also, I mean, really, an episode where at the moment you probably get just as much input into current events by listening to someone throw garden tools down some stairs. So your ear absorption of the show is very much appreciated. Again, please do donate to the show via the Ko-fi or Patreon if you can. Review the show on your pod applicators of choice and tell other people to listen in any way that you can. Maybe write it in all the Bibles in every hotel room you stay in so that this show gains a listenership of people who actually read Bibles in hotel rooms. And in a desperate attempt to please the audience, I'll swap all political content for lounge jazz versions of classic hymns. Or, maybe I won't. Thanks again to Acast for hosting this background noise in amongst its orchestra of sounds, to my brother, the Last Skeptic, for all the tunes, and to Cat Day for typing up the linear liner notes every goddamn week. This will be back next week when Theresa May will have told EU leaders that she needs an extension because she has a dentist appointment and the EU allow her 4 extra days, during which she just keeps presenting a completely unchanged deal to Parliament every 2 minutes until she's sectioned. Bye. This week's show is brought to you by Burkow's Little Book of 400-Year-Old Solutions. Bit of a headache? Check John's Little Book, as chances are you need some bloodletting. Good luck. Need some fashion tips, ladies? How about a debilitating farthingale for under your dress? Comfy until you get splinters. Got guests coming by and struggling to think of what fancy food to serve? Well, the Burkow 400-year-old menu won't let you down. With suggestions of how to make lashings and plain porridge made with sewage water or plain porridge made with the bile of an orphan slave. Mm-mm. Burkow's Little Book of 400-year-old Solutions for when you need a little bit of history to solve life's menial mysteries.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.